Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
Welcome to the Buzz on Technical Rescue. I'm Bob Dumel, your host for the show. Today we'll be talking with Rob Schnapp, Assistant Chief with the Alameda County Fire Department, about a new and innovative course being developed at the National Fire Academy. Before we begin, I'd like to let you know about a few new features being developed here at Firehouse.com and within Firehouse Magazine. Starting in this month's issue of Firehouse Magazine is a new section dedicated to technical rescue. Our goal is to provide the most current and informative materials related to the technical rescue field. Equipment innovations, incident-related articles, training insights, and human interest segments are but a few of the topic areas we hope to cover within this technical rescue segment. The December issue contains a great number of articles related to technical rescue. Scott Goodwin begins a series on confined space entry, while Rule Duvalier from the New Orleans Fire Department talks about highline rope work. Also in a second article by Rule in this issue, he provides great insight to the joint training efforts of the New Orleans Fire Department and the Coast Guard Auxiliary for floodwater rescue. An additional feature being developed is a quarterly technical rescue e-newsletter, which is going to be packed with links to training, technical rescue forums, products, and other information to help you get your job done. You can sign up for this new e-newsletter by following the link on the podcast player page. Lastly, you can see us live at Firehouse World in San Diego, California, February 26th through March 2nd, where we'll be recording the Buzz on Technical Rescue in front of a live audience. Tune in next month for more details on that subject. So on to today's podcast. Our program will be taking a look at a new course which is being developed at the National Fire Academy in Emmitsburg, Maryland, entitled Program Management for Special Operations. During our session today, we'll be talking about professional development as related to special operations in the rescue community. Our show is coming from the National Fire Academy in Emmitsburg, Maryland. Right now, we're taking part in a brand new course being offered at the Academy on Hazardous Materials Special Operations Program Management. My guest today is Rob Schnapp. Rob's one of the instructors for this program at the National Fire Academy. He's also the Special Operations Chief for the Alameda County Fire Department in California. Some of Rob's other interests include being a primary author of a textbook entitled Hazardous Materials Awareness and Operations. Rob's a member of the NFPA Technical Committee on Hazardous Materials Response Personnel, and he also works as an instructor for the U.S. Defense Threat Reduction Agency, which provides hazardous materials WMD training to an international audience. Rob, thanks for joining me today.
Sure, Bob. Thanks.
Kind of get into the program. We'll do maybe a little bit of an overview of the program. Kind of start us out with the background and what brought this particular program to the table.
The program came to fruition after the realization that there was somewhat of a gap in the management piece of unique operational programs, special operations to be exact. And when you take a look at the fire service, the special operations program manager is in a very unique position. However, there's really nothing out there in terms of a national curriculum or any great place a person can go to get the skills and the knowledge and the abilities to step into a real specialized position like that and be able to manage a very complex set of unique functions.
When we start talking about the position itself, we talk about a manager. A program manager related to this, what are some of the skill sets that you look to develop in a person and that somebody should be looking at within themselves to bring to the table to maybe fill one of these positions?
Well, I think when we look at the fire service across the country, we've done, I think, a bit of a disservice to our folks that are taking promotional exams and being put into management positions without really coming into the job with a good skill set to be successful in that position. So, in my opinion, many firefighters come into the job and they don't have aspirations as they begin their career to be in management positions, and suddenly after a number of years they find themselves dealing with perhaps million-dollar budgets and managing a number of people and having to answer to city councils and fire chiefs and justify purchases and haven't really been trained to do that. And this program will address some of those gaps and help the people coming into the position to be successful, and also incumbent people to give them some perhaps better skills and abilities to be successful.
Excellent. And, you know, talking about our organizational leadership qualities that we'd be looking to develop in someone, what are a couple of the things that are good bullet points for a listener to maybe do on their own to help do professional development for themselves prior to getting to this level?
Well, I think if we look at special operations in particular, we'll start over. When you look at special operations management, program management specifically, in some respects it's not much different than managing any other sorts of programs. There are still budgetary issues that have to be dealt with. There are personnel issues, recruitment, retainment, and sustainment of the program, equipment purchasing, those sorts of things. Special operations is a little unique in the fact that we have very specialized functions that we're also the program manager of, and things like technical rescue, water rescue, hazardous materials response, perhaps specialized medical programs, that sort of thing. And so the person who takes this position really has to be an effective manager and have some idea of the specialized functions that are underneath them.
One of the things we see coming into the special operations community recently is it's been around just long enough to where we're starting to see a rotation of some of our leadership. What are some of the things we can do to improve our ongoing programs and to help promote program sustainment?
Can you ask that one more time?
Okay, start over. In the area of program sustainment, what are some of the tools or concepts that may be useful or that may be brought out in a program like this to help a individual or a department maintain the programs that they started and now they see a rotation in personnel? What can we do to help that next wave of employee who comes into a position?
Well, I think the first point you touched on, sustainment, is really important. And I honestly think the very first thing that we can do is understand that the program requires sustainment. And in many cases, beginning any new sort of an endeavor within special operations or anything else is really the easy part. It's looking down the road and trying to figure out how you can secure a predictable source of funding, how you can keep motivated people in the positions, how you can continually get internal support and a political will behind your programs. And I think the very first thing is to understand as a program manager that all those are very real. And typically the people that come into these jobs are could be technical experts, or they're very well versed out in the field, and realizing that the game has completely shifted when you take a managerial role. So I think the newer folks coming in have to realize it's a tremendous shift in thinking when you leave a line job dealing with problems in the field. It's a completely different set of problems that you deal with when you're in the management position. So sustainment, first of all, needs to be just recognized that it needs to be there. Unfortunately, our succession planning in the fire service is probably not as robust as it should be. And so I think typically as the incumbent folks in the job leave, we don't do a great job of briefing our new people coming in or preparing them to take the position. So it's sort of a two-edged sword. Is that there are all these things that are required, sustainment, as I mentioned before, and capital funding, that sort of thing. And a person comes into the job not even knowing what they really don't even know. And so it's difficult, and sometimes that on-the-job training can be very costly for a couple of years as you try to find your way.
And with that, we start talking about, you know, professional development is related to the standards an individual has to work up to. Through this, do you think it's a benefit for a person coming in with field experience in technical rescue activities to be a program manager? Or does the individual who has little or no background in a specific specialty have equally as strong capabilities when they come to the program? Or which would one bring and the other have? How would they compare to each other?
Well, I think that's an interesting question. I think the most obvious way to approach that would be to say that, and I think the most logical way would be to say that a person with technical skills would have an easy time managing a program, but in fact, that's probably not true. There's, I'd say, a minimal amount of transferable line skills that a person who gets into a managerial position would bring with them. They certainly would understand what happens in the field, but realizing that there's a whole other orbit above them, things that they need to deal with, dealing with purchasing agents, securing purchase orders, putting out requests for proposals and requests for quotes, and dealing with vendors and dealing with staffing issues and those sorts of things. And it's really two completely different things. So I think the when you look at a person who comes in from the field, they may have a better view of what's happened in the field, but it doesn't necessarily mean they're going to really understand how to manage a program. On the other side, when you look at good managers or people that have had managerial backgrounds or have perhaps gained the skill somewhere away from the fire service, I think a person with strong management skills can hit the ground running in this position maybe a little bit easier. And while they may not have the technical skills, I think they have the savvy to understand to go to subject matter experts and trusted sources of information. And I think they typically make good managerial and leadership decisions all the way around. So I think to answer your question, it does, a good technical person doesn't always equate to a great leader. But I think in a lot of cases, a great manager can turn into a person who understands what happens in the field and can be effective taking over the reins of the program.
Okay, great. So we start looking into the course itself, we look at some of the different segments that are presented to the students. One of the early components is doing a risk analysis. In most communities, this is something that's done by your emergency management organizations. But by doing this in the class, it's really an eye-opener for the student. Kind of give us a little insight as what future value a program manager gets by understanding maybe a little bit more in-depth background of the whys behind what they're asked to do.
Well, I think one of the at the base level, a special operations program manager has to understand what's happening in the jurisdiction, whether that's on a macro level with mass gathering venues or large chemical facilities or shipping channels or railroad yards. Those are the easy ones. I think the special ops program manager also needs to be concerned with minor transportation routes and smaller chemical facilities or places that manufacture on a lesser scale but are still very prevalent within the jurisdiction. And I think it gives the program manager the ability to feel the pulse of what's going on in the jurisdiction and then better match and plan for how that program should evolve to meet those hazards. And while it is an emergency management function, I think it's certainly beneficial for the special ops program manager to be able to go through a process on his or her own to come to some conclusions and not rely on the judgments of others in terms of what the threat level might be or what the hazard level might be. And again, if the person who's managing the program is in tune with the hazards that they have to deal with, then I think they'll better prepare their team to deal with those.
It sounds like a very good starting point. This way, the more we know about what we're being asked to do and have the personal and policy background behind it, I think we really can make some much more educated and fiscally responsible decisions for the communities that are being served by these individuals. Another area we move into is evaluating our resources. By teaching a new or a current program manager additional skills in evaluating resources, what is this going to do to help them both do their job better and to provide a better tool for their individual departments?
Well, I think the concept of evaluating your team resources is really a natural segue from taking a look at what the hazards are in your particular jurisdiction. And really, it's the second piece of that is once you identify what's happening outside your doors, so to speak, the next logical step would be to figure out what you have in your own back pocket to deal with those problems or those hazards. And so in looking at the team resources is really pretty wide-ranging, and resources aren't limited to specialized equipment. Resources also include people. It includes the funding source. It includes record-keeping. It includes understanding what the culture of your organization is in terms of accepting special operations in general. And it really is what you think you can bring to bear when the time comes to solve the problems that you've identified in being involved in your risk assessment process.
Do you think at times the department's specific culture has a role in the direction their special operations take over time?
Yeah, absolutely. I think in the fire service we somewhat take for granted and confuse tradition and history with culture. And it really, they are three different things. And I think we can acknowledge the traditions of our business, we can acknowledge the history, but that doesn't directly affect the culture of each individual organization. So I think a special operations program manager has to really look inward to the organization and find out and ask questions really about where the program sits politically within the organization, how it's viewed by others in the organization, and special operations is always an evolving thing because the regulations are changing, staffing is changing, that sort of thing. And so I think it's really important that a program manager look and see what the culture is and if that culture is friendly toward change, if it's resistant to change, if there's any other influences that would inhibit or actually help the program manager do their job. So I think to answer your question is it really takes a thoughtful evaluation of the organization, the people, the personalities for that program manager to look and see how to time capital purchases and how to time other requests for money and to be really interested in, and thoughtful about what's going on inside the organization.
A couple moments ago, as part of your response, you were talking about staffing. Staffing covers a broad gamut of activities. One of the term that's used quite often in many of our specialties, the hazmat world, technical rescue, various things, is typing. Different types of overhead requirements, either through FEMA or other organizations that kind of steer us towards specific numbers or staffing types. What are the type of things a student will gain through this program in that area to understand and better utilize staffing needs and requirements?
Well, we're in the people business, and we are people that respond to other people when they are having difficulties. And staffing at the end of the day is really one of the most dynamic resources that we have. And I think coming to this program, the student will have the access to other students who have different staffing patterns. And I think one of the things that's beneficial are all the discussions that happen in the classroom about how alternative staffing patterns are made, how you can rearrange people to perhaps better put them in a place to respond quickly or differently. And I think the value of coming to the National Fire Academy is that there are so many people from so many different walks of life with so many different programs that a student can't help but have a better understanding for all the different options that they may have available to staff their program.
And I think a statement you actually made earlier this week when we were talking is if you've seen one special operations program, you've seen one, which really summed it up quite well. We look at a room of 17-plus individuals, and as you so well put it, we probably have 17 distinctively different but very similar special operations programs and or needs. By bringing everyone together here, what is one of the benefits as an instructor of a program of this type do you see for the students as they interact with one another?
Well, I'd have to say, as an instructor, I think I learn as much as anybody else in the room because there are just so many different opinions, and that is true. If you've seen one special ops program, you've seen just one because it all means different things to different people. Metro fire departments will be different than small fire departments, will be different than really very large fire departments, and it's really great to see all the interaction in these classes here at the Fire Academy and all the different ways that the students are willing to share their experiences and to help others. And it's great as the instructor to look out and watch these interactions happen and see people taking notes and asking good pointed questions. And you can see that they're really processing the information. And the hope is that when they get back to their own organizations, they're able to implement some of these things that they have learned, or at least to give them the ability to think differently about some of the problems that they may be facing.
You know, and keeping in tune with the staffing issue, kind of give us a little bit of an overview for staffing purposes, some of the types of special operations teams that are addressed in this type of a course or in special operations in general for our listeners.
The students bring a number of different disciplines within special operations, but I think they really break down into a few different categories, and hazardous materials response is typically the flagship of almost any special operations unit or program. Many programs that have special ops programs, it is hazardous materials. But others that include technical rescue of a number of different kinds. There are surface rescue, surface water rescue programs, machinery rescue. There are confined space rescue teams, structural collapse, I think I've mentioned. And so there are a number of rescue disciplines that we typically sort of lump into one thought process when we talk about rescue. So hazmat is definitely one. Rescue of all different flavors is another. And many special operations teams have specially trained paramedics like tox medics or hazmatics that would respond as part of a hazmat team or perhaps just on engine companies or truck companies or rescues and provide a higher level of response to chemical exposures.
You know, when we look at staffing our teams, one of the first things that comes up, budgetary constraints. You see a large variety, as you mentioned, from small communities to large federally operated teams coming through a facility such as the National Fire Academy. We're all facing the same issues, but I think one of the big benefits a program like this does is it identifies where we need to put our efforts, where we need to put our funding for the betterment of the community, because our number one goal should be that of the customer, the person we're out there serving. How did the customer's view or needs play into the development of this program?
I think the development piece of it, we acknowledge that tight budgets are a reality and likely will not go away anytime soon. And I think when you look at it at its most base level, tight funding really costs you the ability to do what you want to do in the program. And I think in special operations, everybody wants to have a fully staffed program with all the high-tech equipment and great apparatus. The reality is that really isn't going to happen. So tight budgets force you to look inward and make hard decisions about your program and really decide what you need to do. In some cases, I think it's healthy. It may not seem like it, but when money is tight, decisions are made that you might not make otherwise. And I think in many cases, it forces you to run as lean as possible and to really look at ways to trim costs off of purchases and negotiate shrewdly with vendors and to really think through a purchase before you pull the trigger on it to make sure that it's something that you really want to dedicate that really valuable capital toward.
And, you know, one of the areas associated to this is we hear the term unfunded mandates used quite often. These are placed upon communities, agencies, different operational groups by legislative bodies or other overhead operations within our community. So they're definitely having a kind of a control factor on the flow of funding. One of the biggest activities a team or a special operations capacity has is the equipment that they use. What are some of the tools that are being given to the student to help determine, you know, what equipment is needed and what impact it'll have on their department or their agency?
The biggest message that we try to instill in the students is that any purchase that's made will have an effect on something else in the program. And that equipment really isn't about just purchasing the piece of equipment. There are a host of factors that need to be considered. Training, initial and ongoing training, servicing the equipment, sending it back to vendors, warranty programs. Will the piece of equipment fit into the piece of apparatus you want it to? How will you keep up with the technology? And so I think through some of the exercises we do here at the Academy, it forces the student to go through or to develop a predictable way to make decisions that are thoughtful. And what we try to do is to look beyond the features of a piece of equipment and try to understand the benefits. And the difference is the features are those things that are intrinsic to the piece of machinery. It's a whistle that sounds or a light that comes on or a particular way that it fits into your hand or fits into the apparatus. And a benefit is really what that piece of equipment does for you. Does it allow you to make better decisions? Does it allow you to get someplace quicker? Does it allow your people to be safer or to communicate better? And so we really hope to instill a culture in the individual person about trying to distinguish between features and benefits and not be seduced by all the technology that's out there in the fire service today. So I think you have to look at equipment kind of holistically in your whole organization, because there are just so many unintended things that people don't really pay attention to. And the analogy I like to use is that in your agency or some agency you know, somebody bought a fire engine that wouldn't fit in the firehouse. And that's a complete illustration of really not looking at the piece of equipment entirely.
Very good point. I know one of the key elements I took out of that particular session was the concept of having a good training plan for a piece of equipment. It was indicated, you know, the initial training is where many individuals, departments, stop the process. And at that point, really, they've just gotten the game going. The importance of having recurrent training on the equipment to maintain these competency levels, but also have a process in place for when we get the new members so that they can come in and get their skill sets up to a level equal of their more senior peers within an operational group. These types of tools, I think, are going to be valuable, especially to a new program manager or special operations unit leader who's just recently taken over the reins. Many of these skill sets, like you referred to earlier, you're leaving the traditional line or riding the side of an apparatus component of your career and now going into more of an administrative component. Looking at equipment as an example, I like to use the term, you have wants and you have needs. We need to come up with a balance. I think a program like this does a really good job of helping to educate the program manager as to how to divide those up and give them both the attention due, but to do the right thing with the limited funding that's available nowadays. Many of the things that help us or govern us in this are the different laws and standards that are applicable to all aspects of the fire service. Kind of just give us a little bit of an in-depth view, just kind of compare laws and standards. Sometimes the terms are used interchangeable, but there's a very definitive difference between a law and a standard. Why don't you give us a little bit on that?
In its simplest terms, laws are those things that are promulgated by federal entities or governmental entities and are enforceable as a law. So, for example, the OSHA laws that govern hazardous materials response are just that, they're laws. They come with fines and penalties in the event that they're broken. Standards are typically consensus-based and voluntary, like the National Fire Protection Association standards. Again, using the hazardous materials response example, NFPA 472 is a consensus standard that provides guidance on training competencies that hazardous materials responders at the operations and technician level might look toward. So really the laws are these non-negotiable things that govern our business, and the standards are things that we can choose to comply with. Some states will adopt the NFPA standards 472, for example, as law, and it carries the same weight as law, but their genesis and how they come to pass are different.
You know, and with that, the different standards also, by showing the program managers and special operations the tools that are available to them, I think is a great eye-opener for an individual who may not have had exposure to or access to the different information sources that are out there. During the learning component on the laws, the standards, and the different aspects that drive our department's operations in this area, one of the things that was talked about is, you know, grants. We always talk about grants and being an additional funding source, but there's a whole nother school of learning to do a grant, to manage a grant, or to even be able to do your first level of evaluation on, are you eligible?
The best way to learn a new skill or improve upon one you already have is to actually put it into practice. Choose from 6 hands-on training classes at Firehouse World 2011 in San Diego this coming February. Classes include trench rescue, firefighter survival, air management, extrication, and more. Learn by doing. Complete details available at firehouseworld.com.
What are a couple of the things that the course has got within its makeup that helps an individual become more skilled and educated in the management of a grant itself?
I think grants, probably within the last 10 years, have become the most misunderstood source of funding in the fire service. It's not uncommon for an entity who's unable to purchase something by some other means to automatically default to the thought that they can get through a grant, and that grants are this pile of money out there that you really just have to show up and pick up, and you can spend it any way you want. And we go to, I think, pretty great lengths in the program to talk about the realities of grant purchasing and how strenuous some of the requirements are and how tight some of the rules are and how long the process could possibly take. And you, as the Special Operations Program Manager, typically are the person who has to perhaps conceive the idea, track down the equipment, write the grant, administer the grant, and to make sure that the piece of equipment is appropriate for what you're doing. So, again, like most other things, starting the program is actually the easy part. It's keeping it up and keeping it maintained. And in a lot of cases, grants purchased before a particular time really don't provide for any sustainment of the piece of equipment that you purchase. And I'm certain that some of your listeners out there right now are sitting on pieces of equipment in their own departments that they couldn't keep up with, or they didn't realize the inherent cost of consumables, or they didn't really realize what it would cost them to send back to be serviced annually, or even the fact that it needed to be serviced annually. So the grant process is really at times fraught with pitfalls that the naive special operations program manager may go into and not really realize what they're trying to bite off.
And I think a program like this helps to identify some skill sets that need to be developed within the individual to make the best out of a grant that comes their way. But at the same time, as you referred to, give them the skills to go the full distance, not to just get into the game and then end up floundering, or bring things into your department that were easily obtained through a grant, but now become a financial burden on the department itself too. So by having better education in the process, better knowledge in the tools within the individual skill sets is definitely going to make the grant program much more successful, I think, as people move through these different stages of development. We also start looking at, you know, how a program works, or what it's out here to provide the community. We hear the term standard of care used within the framework of the course at times. Kind of explain to us what exactly that's referring to, and how does it apply to both the program manager and the program itself?
Well, in general terms, the standard of care is the way that a trained responder would behave given the industry, meaning that a reasonable and prudent responder, given similar training to other responders within that same discipline, should be expected to perform. So it's almost like a scope of practice, I guess, in some respects for a paramedic, is that once you receive training, you should behave and be able to perform like others in your field. And with special operations, it's a little different because in a program that has multiple disciplines, hazardous materials response and rescue and perhaps emergency medicine, the standards of care are different, and it requires the program manager to really be mindful of that. And the program manager, in many cases, is somewhat the bench marker for that standard of care, factoring into the equation all the things that you would deal with the rules and or the laws and the standards, rather. The program manager must take a look at all his response disciplines and decide at what level they will perform and to what standard of care they will perform. So, you know, perhaps they choose to be hazardous materials technicians. And so after the initial training, it's up to the program manager to make sure that those trained technicians maintain a good standard of care consistent with the industry. Same thing with a rescue technician. Once the initial training's done, it's up to that program manager to continue to provide refresher training, proficiency training, competency training, however you refer to it, to make sure that that standard of care is maintained well beyond the initial time that the person went to the class or got the training.
So we're kind of carrying over the same mindset we started with our equipment when we do our training on the equipment, we want to carry that into how we maintain the skills of our rescuers, the actual, you know, feet on the ground individual. One of the good things that exists within our system between the different regulations we work with are the NFPA standards. There's specific ones towards hazardous materials. There's other ones that are geared towards the technical rescue community, but these are brought out in the classroom function as a tool for the student to go back to and to have something permanent and recognized to help guide them in the development of their local programs. What are some of the benefits of going with an NFPA program or standard in an individual's program development?
Well, that's a good question, because the program manager really has to decide to what level the people in the program are going to perform. And the NFPA hazmat standards, the NFPA 472 is a great example. It's been revised in the last revision cycle, and the new version is 2008. And NFPA 472 has really expanded, especially at the operations level, what a trained responder is able to do. And in a nutshell, NFPA 472 is broken down into core competencies and mission-specific competencies. And what's really beneficial to an organization is that it gives the organization the ability to try to actually thoughtfully decide on what they want their responders to do and then match that level of training. So, for example, an agency may decide that they want their hazardous materials technician to do, or the, I'm sorry, their ops level responders to do mass casualty decon. And so they could train them to do all the core competencies in NFPA 472, and out of all the mission-specific competencies, they could select to do additional training in mass casualty decon. They could also select to do additional training in personal protective equipment or victim rescue or perhaps technical decon. And so really, it's important to look at 472, and if your listeners are interested in learning more, they should get a copy of the standard and really digest it, because at the operations level, again, there are a much broader set of skills that an authority having jurisdiction can train their people to. And I think what it does is it increases the utility of the personnel, so that not everybody has to be a hazardous materials technician. Not everybody is limited to doing defensive operations only under the OSHA standard. And so NFPA really broadens the playing field, I think, for especially that operations level responder.
And I think that's an excellent example of the evolution of a process where it's reviewed, they bring subject matter experts in, look at a process, and then keep it moving forward into the future and adapt it according to the needs of the current generation that's utilizing it. By bringing these programs to a course such as this, I think it really enhances the program manager's capabilities to go back home by giving them the exposure to the intimate details of some of these different standards that we may have on the shelves of our offices, some of which could be significantly outdated. So it also helps promote that constantly staying in the learning curve type of mindset. Definitely something the National Fire Academy is renowned for, and its sole purpose is to educate the leaders, current and future, of the fire service and all the different specialties associated to it. So by bringing these people together, the networking capabilities too that grow from it. One of the things we hear two different terms sometimes also used interchangeably, but I think they stand alone on their own. We'll hear a special operations program, and then somebody will refer to their special operations function. Two different things. How does one compare to the other, or where do they fit in the chain of activity?
It goes back to a program manager having to manage the administrative functions of, I'm sorry, the start over. I think when you look at a special operations program, you have to realize that a program is different than the functions that that program administers or manages. And so typically the functions that may occur within the program would be hazmat response, rescue, could be specialized medicine, could be wildland, could be bulldozers. I mean, there's a whole bunch of different functions that could happen. And so really, I think you could look at it this way, is that a program is a sum of its functions, but that program has to manage each of those functions in the same manner in order to balance each of those programs within or each of those functions, rather, within that program. So it might be a bit confusing, but I think the best way to perhaps help your listeners visualize this is by a spider web. And when you take a look at a spider web that's been built in the corner of a room or, you know, perhaps between two tree branches, and you notice if you were to grab one corner of that spider web and pull it slightly, that the whole spider web shifts. And I think that's a great analogy of special ops, because that program manager is trying to keep that spider web balanced at all times, and all the different functions underneath it. Hazmat, for example, requires a replacement of its entire fleet of level A suits in a given year. Well, that spider web is going to shift toward the hazmat function. At the same time, perhaps a motor on a rescue boat has gone out and the spider web gets pulled in a different direction, or the antidote kit for the toxmedic program needs to be replaced across all engine companies and the spider web gets pulled in yet another direction. So I think it's really the special ops program manager, more than almost any other, I think, is kind of a music conductor who's really trying to keep the finger of the pulse, listen to all the buzz that's going on within that program, and to try to keep it all balanced so it all sounds good at the end.
And when you're referring to this pull, obviously the first thing my mind shoots to is finances. You know, what are some of the financial considerations that somebody managing any program in a fire service nowadays really should be aware of, or what are some of the different tools they can use to help broaden their knowledge base of how to work the financial component of their position?
I would have to say, Bob, that finance is really a very interesting facet of this, because most firefighters that come into the fire department are not financial managers by trade. Yet, the finance piece of special ops is probably one of the most important pieces. Back to the person, it also becomes one of the things I think is the least fun thing to do in the job. And so sitting at your office desk working up a budget is typically not what, when you think back to when you came on the job, you signed up to do. When you're going through a purchasing process for over a year to buy a new piece of detection equipment, it can be very frustrating and very time-consuming and seem like it's a never-ending process. And so I think when we look at budgets, it's difficult because it's always there. It's seldom enjoyable. It's mission critical. And we don't typically have a lot of training in that particular discipline. And so it really becomes, in a lot of cases, a millstone around the manager's neck, because it just is so confounding. Purchasing rules are very complex. Dealing with grants is very complex. And so it really is a monster of a piece of the program that has to be acknowledged. Again, on the flip side, without a constant source of funding, special ops programs are really almost out of commission, because the tools are expensive, the training's expensive, the apparatus is expensive, and unfortunately, the call volume is typically not there to justify it, as happens in perhaps looking at engine company efficiency. You know, it's real common to say, well, this particular engine company runs X calls a day and they go to X fires or X medicals, and so therefore the justification of the activity in a particular district is pretty easy to see. Hazmat team could run, in some jurisdictions, 10 or 12 calls a year, yet it's got one of the most expensive pieces of equipment in the fleet. The people that are assigned to the team may or may not be getting specialty pay. Typical gas detection equipment costs several thousand dollars, and so we really bring to bear a high-dollar program on infrequently required or requested services. And it's tough to justify those in these times, and so I think the program manager really must look well beyond call volume and some of the easy things we typically use to justify, and really look at the benefit. So an example may be that a hazmat team was able to respond to a shopping mall in a busy metropolitan area 2 days before Christmas, when the shopping mall is processing $500,000 an evening in there, and there's a white powder discovered. And the hazmat team would respond out, and they were able to do some presumptive field testing and rule out the thought of a legitimate threat. And in the community, the mall is back up and running in a particular amount of time. Those are benefits. Those are benefits of having the team at that point in time, not having to rely on perhaps a team from outside the region or from some other area. And so I think the program manager really has to keep a tally of all the beneficial things that happen perhaps a life is saved, or a great piece of training is achieved, or maybe there's a business that would have been shut down for longer than it needed to be because the special ops team was there. And so really, when it gets to the money piece, that's where a manager, I think, earns his or her pay, is being an observer, being politically connected to try to continue to secure that funding and to be a champion for the program and to make sure that the money continues to fund a beneficial and useful program. Now, having said that, I wouldn't say that all facets of special operations in all organizations are always 100% useful. And so a special ops program manager may have to make a tough decision at some points in time and realize that it really may be time to throttle back or discontinue a service. And that's a tough place to be in, but really have to look at how that special ops program fits within the agency who's trying to address the needs of the community. And the truly objective program manager will look long and hard at the program to make sure that it's useful and beneficial and it serves the needs of the community.
Yeah, and I think it kind of sums up that an individual who moves into one of these positions or currently sits in it for a period of time and is just getting their first real opportunity for some position-specific professional development has to remember that their operations mindset that they possessed and lived with through the early stages of their career really needs to be remolded at this stage of the game. You're now part of an administrative component, and I guess the term visionary would apply well to somebody who hopes to be successful in one of these positions. Many of the things you just recently hit on related to the financial considerations seem to be much more far-reaching than dealing with the call of the moment or today's issue. What benefits of having a good visionary component in one's thought process will a program manager gain from?
I believe the program manager has to make a definitive decision in some cases between what's right and what's right now. And in the fire service, we are in the right now business when we work on the line. The bell goes off, we get on the apparatus, we go out, we solve the problem, we come back to the station and wait for the next one. And it's usually, or I can say for sure, that those calls have a beginning, a middle, and an end, and you're off to the next one. And I think in the special ops realm, it just doesn't work that way. And so we can't get, again, seduced into the right now business as a program manager. We have to figure out what's right. And sometimes not purchasing a piece of equipment, although it may seem to be great, really doesn't make sense in the long run because the use, care, and feeding is going to be too expensive, or we're not committed to the training, or we really don't know who the successor is going to be when this person who's very passionate about a piece of equipment retires. And so the program manager is, in some cases, the conscience of the entire program and has to look at it that way and to say that I've got to do this right, and the fit for this equipment has to be right, and the purchase that we're making right now has to be right, and the service that we're electing to do or not do is right. And let the people in the field deal with the right now, but the program manager has to really look at things and make sure that it's right. And it, again, keep in mind that special ops is a piece of your organization. It isn't your organization. So we have to really be mindful of, this holistic approach to that, and that piece of equipment you purchase will have some sort of effect all the way through the organization. And so it's redundant, but the program manager really has to make sure that what they're doing is the right fit for the agency.
And I think this kind of brings it together to the point this program was designed for and what it's accomplishing with its students is, in 40 short minutes, we've talked about what, in essence, takes 6 full days to accomplish here at the National Fire Academy, a very busy day for all of its participants, very intense as far as the requirements, the reading assignments, and the things that help evolve. But the one big benefit, I think, of coming to the National Fire Academy for a program like this is also you have plenty of people to lean upon one another for support. The networking in a facility like this is under the infamous category of priceless. What you're gaining from others life experiences, work experiences, and general knowledge are some great tools you can take home. And whether it's this course or anything here at the Academy, I think it's one of the educational components. The fire service is very beneficial, and you know, more folks should take advantage of these opportunities, you know, to broaden your horizon, improve your professional skills, but also to bring it back to your own department in your community, and you know, bring things to them for the future generation to benefit from. You know, Rob, I want to thank you for joining me today. Just any closing thoughts or things you have that would kind of bring this all together from your perspectives, from an instructor or a career person in the fire service itself?
No, not really. I think you did make an excellent point in that I would encourage every one of your listeners to apply for some class at the Academy and to come here, because you may spend 8 hours in the classroom, but you spend many, many more hours informally having conversations with your peers. And myself as an instructor, I learn more sitting down, having lunch, and having the conversations away from the classroom as much as I do in the classroom. And so it is a great facility. There are great people here, a lot of good minds, and it really sort of is the epicenter of our business. And so thanks for having me, and hopefully your listeners will get something out of it and come on out to the Academy and take the class.
Well, Rob, thanks again. Appreciate you for taking your time. This is your host, Bob Dumo, for the Buzz on Technical Rescue. Hope you enjoyed today's show. Remember, be safe and keep listening.
Firehouse World 2011 is the largest fire service event west of the Mississippi and takes place in San Diego, California, February 26th through March 2nd. Register today at firehouseworld.com and be part of the action. You will have access to over 100 training and educational sessions, 350 exhibitors, plus network with over 7,500 firefighters from around the country. This is one event you don't want to miss.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.